and welcome to this week's House of Comments podcast. My name is Emma Burnell, and I'm a Labour-supporting blogger who blogs at the Scarlet Standard. And I'm delighted today to be joined by Mark Wallace, who is the Executive Editor of Conservative Home. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
And Hopi Sen, who is a former Labour Party staffer and blogger and commentator. Hi, Hopi.
Hiya.
Lovely. Well, thank you both very much for joining me. Obviously, I have the privilege that my two fellow regular hosts of the House of Commons podcast do not have, in that I don't have to worry about about gender balance, because I can always make sure that I run no all-male podcast. But I thought I have obviously got two male guests with me today. So I thought it might be an interesting thing to kick off the discussion on the criticism that there's been of the Conservatives this week, that they are not a female-friendly party, either in terms of policy or particularly this week, there's been in terms of representation. Mark, is it fair? Is it criticism that you think is reflective of the truth?
Well, I don't think it's fair to say the Conservative Party isn't women-friendly. It's certainly the case that in much less enlightened times, you know, the Conservative Party is still the only one that's provided the Britain's only female Prime Minister. So, and times have improved even more since then, I think, in terms of attitudes, in terms of policy and so on. I think it's, however, definitely the case the Conservative Party does have what's kind of euphemistically been termed in the media this week a women problem. David Cameron has basically had to abandon his pledge on the percentage of the cabinet who were going to be female ministers. Frankly, serious PR misstep on Wednesday at PMQs, where they failed to notice until the last minute the bear trap that Miliband had laid for them, has laid bare the problem that we do have. If you combine that with the number of first-term female MPs who either have left or are stepping down in 2015, there clearly is an issue. It's something that's taken quite a long time to sort out. And I think it's despite protestations in Westminster, it's going to take years and years to sort out still.
And how, I mean, I understand that it's not really in the Conservative mindset to adopt a measure like all women shortlists. It goes against the grain somewhat for the Conservative Party in a way that it hasn't done with the Labour Party so much, although there is obviously the occasional house of protestation. So if that's not the measure that you would choose to adopt, and maybe you personally would, what can be done?
Well, I would go along with mainstream Conservative thinking on this, that might be an oxymoron or not, about the general opposition to all women shortlists. I don't think they're particularly helpful, except in a statistical sense. And the point of equality is not a statistical thing. Equality and fair representation is about quality as much as it is about quantity. I think part of what we've got to do is actually to restate the fact that we are not ashamed of the fact that Mrs. Thatcher plays such a huge part in our political and historical record, for example. I also think it's really important, if you look at what's being done in business, a huge amount of this, what's being done to start to address the balance in boardrooms, for example, is self-organisation, support networks, skill sharing, training, etc., etc. And I think that will make the biggest difference in this. You know, there's one aspect of the so-called women problem in the Conservative Party, which I think is pretty bogus, is the question of, say, Anne McIntosh's deselection. Looking at the number of extremely talented, extremely popular female candidates who've been coming forward in the last 6 months, I wouldn't be at all surprised to see quite a few Tory selections pick really high-quality female candidates over the next few months. And a big part of this is the fact that this kind of generational change takes time. You see this not just in politics, but also in business, as I've mentioned, in the law. The fact is that you can't just solve something by a statistical fix. What you need to do is accept that it does take some time for people to progress through the ranks, to build up experience, and to reach a point where they get selected for these top jobs, by which we rightly judge whether we're securing equality or not.
Hopi, you've been a former member of party staff, so presumably you've watched the changes to the party since all women shortlists were brought in time for the 97 election. Do you think that they have been what's changed the party, or have we been going through this cultural shift just a little earlier?
I think if you look at the areas where we haven't introduced positive discrimination, positive discrimination hasn't really happened at all, and the two areas in the labour movement I point to are some areas of council selection where positive discrimination didn't come in really until about 2006-07, and in the trade union movement, which is still, frankly, incredibly backward, despite Frances O'Grady's role as head of the TUC. I don't think there's a single female general secretary of a major trade union at the moment. Shows the difference that positive discrimination has made in the Parliamentary Labour Party. It is probably the one area of Labour politics where you can see how much that difference makes. And without it, I don't think really we would probably be in a very different position to the Conservatives. I don't think the Conservative Party has a women problem. I think it has an entrenched power and privilege problem, which extends from men to the level of number of public school educated people. And the position of women in the party is symbolic of that. And without specific mechanisms to change that, I think it's going to take a very, very long time for the Conservative Party to alter. And I say that, looking self-critically at the Labour Party, there are areas where we've not made those changes, where we've not pushed hard enough, where frankly it's just as bad. I don't, if it had been the trade union general secretaries lined up against the Conservative front bench on Wednesday, it would have been a pretty even battle. And I don't think the Labour Party can rest on its laurels at all in this battle.
I completely agree. As you know, I'm quite happy to take my own party's task, possibly happier doing that than pointing the finger at the other parties. Until I believe that we're better than we are, I think pointing fingers at other parties isn't necessarily the most helpful thing that we can do. We can continue to lead by example by getting better, and we are not perfect. And I think the trade union movement is a very good example of that. I have worked in the trade union movement in the past, and it did feel like a very macho culture, even though the part I was working in was probably the least macho part of it at all. And in some ways, that was why the part I was working in was somewhat looked down upon.
And I think even if you extend back into local councils, I think although there is now the rule that one in three Labour candidates in any particular ward should be a woman, that is still a significant step back from where we should be. And it's also a significant step back when you look at where power often is in local councils and in leadership. And I think we've still got far too few women council leaders and far too few women council cabinet members. And I think that's just as important. There's a danger for the Labour Party is that we think we're doing great because we can have a front bench, but that actually represents a very narrow elite of women that have succeeded, and they're resting really on a superstructure which is effectively just not that different to any other political party. And that's something we've got to be aware of in the Labour Party, rather than being smug about exactly how much better we are than the Conservatives. To be fair to the Conservative Party, whilst I think they're completely wrong to rule out positive discrimination, I think it's a mistake, and I think it will rebound negatively on them. I think there is the younger Conservatives are genuinely interested in seeing gender balance in representation. It's just that without positive discrimination, it's going to take far too long to do them any political good.
Yeah, I think there's a very interesting mechanism which has started emerging while I've been following the selections over the last few months for Con Home, which is that actually the more competitive a seat is, the more in the balance it hangs, the more likely a Conservative association is to pick a female candidate. It's a problem in terms of representation in Parliament, in that the corollary of that is that safer seats are more likely, I suspect, because they have a more comfortable life, perhaps because they're somewhat more old school, to be picking male candidates, which is still a problem. But it is interesting to see a trend is starting to emerge that in marginal seats, in target seats, those are the Conservative associations which are more likely to be picking female candidates.
That's really interesting.
And I do think that's a sign. In some ways, it's an encouraging sign that there are larger parts of the Conservative Party that are waking up to the fact that actually, if you want to be competitive, then you have to be more representative, which is a positive thing.
Absolutely. I mean, I think part of the problem that goes absolutely across the board is that MPs don't have a job description, really. They don't. There isn't a set of skills particularly, and we all have things that we think we want our MP to be, but, you know, are you selecting a good constituency MP? Are you selecting a future PM? Are you selecting, you know, someone who agrees with you politically, or are you selecting someone that you think will appeal to the electorate? Not always the same thing, although some people will always tell you that it is. And those are usually the people who are least like the electorate. But so there isn't really a clear definition of what an MP, what a selectorate is looking for, and therefore what an MP looks like. But I think if you asked 100 people on the street to close their eyes and picture an MP, picture a generic MP, then 99 out of that 100 are going to choose a grey man in a grey suit. And that may be the problem. The electorate haven't got a clear idea or a fixed idea as to all the skills or the different politics that they want, but they pretty much know what they think an MP looks like, even if that's subconscious.
I'd point to another problem as well, Emma, which is whilst certainly in the Labour Party we've done pretty well in terms of the structures of recruitment and candidate selection, and if you look at the selection round that's happening now, close to 50% of people who are being selected are women, and we're even seeing, and this is really encouraging, women winning the some of the open selections, which kind of you know occasionally get thought of all men shortlist almost as a result of that. But what we've not done at all well, and I don't think the Conservatives or the Liberal Democrats have done well either, is find a way of recruiting more women into the party at the base. So I think it's right to say that it's still something like 60-40 male-female party membership. And I think as long as you have that problem in political involvement, you're going to see pressures all the way up. Because you're just looking, you know, you go to constituency party meetings, and there will be more men and women, and therefore that leads into every single bit of the organisation feeds through. So I think that's an area we have to look at as well, which is how do we rebalance our politics to make sure that it is encouraging involvement at every level, rather than only worrying about the top. That isn't to say worrying about the top isn't important; it's crucially important. But if you're looking for a long-term solution involving more women at membership level and recruiting more women members, should be as big a priority as candidate selection.
Absolutely, and I think that again, Mark, that probably speaks to across the parties. I think sometimes the whole of politics feels quite male dominated and quite masculine, quite macho, quite closed off. I certainly, you know, when you go to branch meetings, I don't know what the Conservative Party experience is like, but I strongly suspect you're as awful as we are in terms of having a very closed structure. You know, you have the minutes of the last meeting and all that sort of thing.
Absolutely. To be honest with you, after what Hopi said, I'm just imagining what it would be like to be a member of a party that was so transparent it actually published that breakdown for its membership. You've got to bear in mind that the Tory party didn't publish its membership figures at all until Conservative Home, he said, plugging the website, managed to kind of persuade them to do it last September. So, I think transparency is always a step in that direction. But, yeah, I mean, if you look, for example, to take one very unusual microcosm, to look at, say, university politics and university party politics in particular, yes, it is very male-dominated, and that's to the extent that's become a wide joke about youth politics. And if you don't have people joining at the grassroots, if you don't have people becoming activists, then, as you say, it's incredibly hard to make having equality run through the higher echelons of that without simply engaging in tokenism. And these are all things we've got to try and sort out. I mean, that said, there are, I would say, or I don't have the numbers to hand, the increasing number of female Conservatives who are prominent in the local government level, for example, the number of kind of group leaders, council leaders, and so on, does seem to me to have been rising. But there's undoubtedly still a long way to go.
Well, the one thing I would say is that. If you look back historically, some of the greatest ways of getting women involvement have been conservative. I mean, obviously we know about Margaret Thatcher, but go back to the Primrose League and things like that. There was a huge tradition of women involvement in the Conservative Party that wasn't really matched in the Labour Party, and indeed for much of the 50s and 60s, the Conservatives had an explicitly feminine pitch that wasn't replicated in the Labour Party. And one warning to the left is you shouldn't expect that methods that will involve women in politics are necessarily going to appear to be left-wing methods. It would be entirely possible to kind of, you know, to see a generation of women's involvement in politics, which is, for example, kind of negative to what the current feminist agenda or modern feminist agenda would look like. And that is also important. It's still women's voices in
absolutely,
politics.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I for example, I'm thinking about Katie Hopkins. Now, Katie Hopkins is the anathema of everything that I believe in. And she's doing herself a good career by being the anathema of everything that I believe in and doing it in such a way that generates a lot of media attention. She's very, very good at getting and keeping attention. And a great deal of the criticism that she gets is not about her opinions, although some of it is, but about her, it's gendered. You know, she's a screechy, harpy woman, and this is coming from the people of the left who don't like her opinions, and it's so easy for those two things to blend together and then to make it a much more, you know, much more difficult for any woman to feel that she can be strident about her views in the way that men just don't think about considering questioning that. So I think, you know, I don't want to see the end of Katie Hopkins' media career because she's a woman. I'd like us all not to agree with her. But I get very upset when the disagreements come because of the way that she come in such a way that make me think, well, I don't think you'd be saying that if she was as equally awful bloke.
Yeah,
I think
we've seen this with a number of prominent women in politics. I mean, obviously there's a Thatcher example, which you've mentioned quite a lot, but also if you look at, say, Anne Widdecombe, for example, you know, her politics undoubtedly not to the taste of either of you on some topics, not to my own taste, but so much of the criticism was actually defeminizing. This process of almost not just mocking, but almost trying to remove someone's qualification to be counted as a woman in terms of that criticism, which is remarkably vicious, and it's small wonder that will be deterring to quite a lot of people. I think what you to go back very quickly to what you were saying earlier, Emma, about the idea of what is the job description for an MP. I think that's one of the reasons why I suspect quite a few new first term MPs on our leaving is that actually what they expected an MP's life to be like, but also actually what it was sold as has not turned out to match their expectations, or for that matter not turned out to match necessarily what they feel they can give, and you know, that's quite a serious problem in this field as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, Hope, did you want to come in there?
No,
I mean, I was thinking back to the model of conservative activism. My grandmother was a conservative street captain. Obviously, we didn't agree on politics. She was a fantastic, incredibly strong, very well-organised woman who could organise a sit-down dinner for 40 at the drop of the hat. And I believe frequently did so for her local Conservative Association. That was that role that in some ways was as much about organising and community as it was about the other structures and discipline. And maybe that's part of the way that Labour can change it is to go further into this idea of community organising. Although that project is being led by a man in Arnie Graf, I tend to think of it as quite a feminising project. Hope, have you got any thoughts on...
Well, as you know, as a political mechanism, I'm quite, you know, I'm on the relatively sceptical end of the value of community organising as a short-term election-winning strategy. I have huge respect for it as a long-term movement-building strategy. I certainly think, as you know, if the question we're asking ourselves is how do we get more people involved in politics, and how do we get them to kind of contribute to the wider political debate, that strategy is absolutely crucial. I think there's also kind of a risk for us in politics to kind of, you often see in political leaders' offices a gender divide between the organisational, managerial, administrative side of politics, which is absolutely crucial, and the kind of policy, strategic, wonky side of politics, which tends to be very male. And you cannot even go into offices and see a kind of, you know, lots of boys in blue shirts.
Boys in grey suits, we called them on the Ed campaign.
and then you go into the visits, events, and press team, and it's, you know, almost the reverse. And we tend to think one is more important than the other. And certainly when you get admiring profiles about kind of the court of the party leader, it tends to be the boys in blue shirts who get the write-ups, possibly because they talk to journalists who are also boys in blue shirts. I don't know. And I think that that's a problem for politics as well, which we don't recognise how important some of these roles are, and we don't give them the status and the significance that they deserve. Because, you know, if you went through, you know, go back a little bit in history, if you look at the people who were important in the Blair administration, people like Sally Morgan, Angie Hunter, Hillary Kaufman, and a whole host of others were as or more significant than Peter Mandelson and Alistair Campbell in making the project work. But who is famous and who is known? Well, I would say Campbell and Mandelson have, you know, dominate that in a way that there isn't. So we're sexist even in the way that we kind of view organisations and structures, and that's a thing we have to address as well.
Absolutely. Okay, well, I think we've probably done this one to death for this week. I can't imagine it won't come up again, but I'm sure we'll find a new way to talk about the inequality of politics next time it does. One of the other big issues of the week has been the floods and the handling of the floods by the Environment Agency and or DEFRA, and who is ultimately responsible for what has and hasn't gone wrong. It's been a very difficult week for a lot of people, particularly people living in further out rural areas in the southwest in particular, and it's also been a lot of politicking around who's caused that difficulty. Mark, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think what we're seeing is yet another instance of politicians being hoisted on their own petard. For so long it's been convenient and you know, a positive thing for politicians to essentially promise to be able to solve anything if it means they get good headlines the next day or the following Sunday. But when it turns out they promise to solve things that actually are incredibly difficult to solve and certainly can't be solved in the short term, then they end up paying the price for it. And that's part of what we're seeing at the moment. You know, it's certainly the case that the flooding of the Somerset Levels is in large part due to human error. There are places, other parts of the country, most notably the Norfolk Broads, which are artificial land, essentially. This has been drained by human action for hundreds of years. And in the Somerset Levels, where the Environment Agency controls it, they are now flooding because humans made a mistake and decided to stop dredging. The problem is that for so long we've got used to the idea, or rather our media culture and political culture is used to the idea that politicians can swoop in and, you know, send in whatever magical forces they might have at their disposal to solve everything. That when something takes an extremely long time to solve, it becomes a crisis. And, you know, we have a crisis. To a certain extent, the government are incredibly fortunate that Chris Smith and other senior members of the Environment Agency are handling this so badly in a PR sense. And I think they've been quite lucky with that so far. I mean, the latest senior Environment Agency official who said that there had been some successes, but he said it in such a way that it sounded like he was saying this particular Somerset Levels crisis was a success, is, you know, allows yet more fire to be redirected at the Quango instead of at the government. But, I mean, what a titanic mess.
Absolutely. Hopi, anything to add to what's a terrible mess?
Well, I have possibly the least experience, expertise or knowledge of anyone you can possibly imagine about flood management and dredging. So I'm not going to comment on that. I will leave that to someone who knows much more about it than me. Other than to say that the one person I think would be most delighted by the events of the last week will be Michael Gove, who was being savagely attacked last week for trying to get rid of a Labour placement in a Quango by everyone, and then discovers this week that the person to blame for everything in the world is apparently another Labour Quangocrat, which got him off the hook marvellously, because, you know, whilst I'm sure Chris Smith is a wonderful and brilliant man and a fantastic administrator, and the criticisms of the Environment Agency and his leadership are entirely ill-founded, as a political narrative, it is not particularly comfortable for an ex-culture secretary to be in charge of our response to a great natural disaster relating to weather. And it's not entirely clear how exactly that was the most important and significant leadership you should have in that sort of situation. On the more general point that Mark was making, is I just find it interesting that the government doesn't seem to really believe that it can act in a really massively significant way. And that meant that it was very slow in the appearance of action. It may be right, as Mark said, that there wasn't actually very much the government could do, but they certainly gave the impression that they really believed there wasn't much they can do. And I would suggest, even if you can't do very much, looking as if you could, and as looking as if you're trying to, is very, very important for a politician. And I think the government fell down on that. The contrast I would make is, if you look at what happened in Germany about 6 or 7 years ago when they had huge flooding, and Gerhard Schröder toured relentlessly and, absolutely day in, day out in an area which was entirely not his area politically, or even when Gordon Brown was Prime Minister and there was flooding in Gloucester and the surrounds. The appearance of action politically is as valuable as the action itself. It's not as valuable in terms of helping people, but in terms of getting your message across, it's very important.
Not enough,
if you don't believe that government...
TV pictures of Cameron with the sleeves rolled up.
Well, you don't wait until people are demanding action before you do that, because then you're immediately going to look ludicrous. What you have to do is you have to really believe about the difference you can make. And I suspect that in an odd way, a possibly justified cynicism about the role of government in such a situation has actually undercut the government's messaging, and they'd be better off acting as if they believed in the power of government, even if it wasn't actually true.
Yeah, I agree that it ought to be quite straightforward in political comms terms to not let Prince Charles beat you to a national disaster. it should be a pretty fundamental principle that you shouldn't even have to write down. I think this Quangocrat thing is a very important point. Now this has happened. Now we've had two senior Labour Quangocrats in the public eye in the space of a week. I think you can just about guarantee this is going to crop up several more times in the coming months, because partially any Quango that's in the news, statistically their leader unfortunately is more likely to be Labour aligned than Tory aligned. But this is now establishing itself as a really crucial story, and it is a scandal in terms of what I think Janet Daly called the Labour march through the institutions. But it's also for Conservatives, certainly for Conservatives on the campaigning and think tank kind of wing of the movement. It's a scandal that the government's failed to sort this out. This is something that many of us were talking about years before the 2010 election. It's remarkable that the government have failed to bite the bullet. The question of this Gove story cropping up as a potential scandal, for a lot of us, it should have been something the government were boasting about from very early on in this government, that we were doing what the people wanted in 2010, which is taking Labour out of power.
And I mean, it does seem to be an odd situation where you've got 2 years ago the bonfire of the Quangos, and 2 years later the too many of our Quangos are run by the wrong, incompetent, by the way, also Labour-supporting people.
And in both cases, actually reappointed or appointed by Conservative cabinet ministers. I mean, both Chris Smith and Sally Morgan were appointed, I think, appointed or reappointed in 2011. So it's not as if they were kind of last minute shove-ins by a Labour hierarchy desperate to retain power against the will of the electorate. Going to Mark's point about why this crops up now, it is actually quite odd that it's taken until 2014 for the Conservatives to sort of start thinking about this as an issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say it's not the first time the leadership of the Conservative Party has failed to pick up on something as soon as it should have. You can think about, I point to matching Labour spending plans in opposition as being another thing that actually, had they worked from first principles, they probably shouldn't have done. But instead, on that occasion, they thought this is something that'll differentiate us from the past. I suspect, looking at the appointment of Sally Morgan by Gove, I think again they thought this is something that makes us look kind of cross-party and so on. Whereas actually, it seems like they've read all those books about Blair's first term in government, and they haven't necessarily drawn all of the right conclusions. You know, they seem to have looked back on it and thought like Blair regretted not doing enough in the first term, so we'll rush through a load of things like privatising forests, regardless of whether they're particularly wise to do. Whereas instead, they should have looked at the things that actually really make a difference, which is who is in a position to start delaying and striking down the reforms that really matter. In a lot of cases, that's the regulators and the quangocrats who, you know, belatedly, 4 years in almost, they're starting to realise they should have dealt with early on.
So, I mean, in terms of where do we go? I mean, is it a case that we should have fewer quangos? Is it a case that we should have the same number of quangos, but more openness about the fact that they're politically appointed, move towards a more American system of personnel being changed every time the leadership does, every time, you know, the Prime Minister does. Would that work?
Personally, yeah, I would favour that. I think that's a clearer and more honest process. I mean, what effectively has happened is that quangos were created sort of as a process, really strongly and heavily in from the 80s onwards, because it became obvious that the size of the state and the management of the state's services was not best directed by the Secretary of State's office in Whitehall, but by specific units tasked with individual purposes. And those expanded because giving them a degree of autonomy to do things in their own way was politically useful and was also better management. Now, you can have criticism of any one of these, but the general principle seems to be right. I mean, you know, both Conservatives and Labour are very in love with localism and devolution and giving power away from Whitehall. Now, the consequence of that still is if you're going to give that power away, somebody is still going to wield it. And if somebody's going to be managing either the monitoring or the delivery of your objectives, that becomes a very politically important role. And I think it's much clearer and more open if you do have clear political leadership of these positions. That would be constitutionally very different for us in Britain, because we don't have a kind of recognised system by that happening. Personally, I would be very happy to see kind of, you know, sort of a wave of think tank people floating in and out with each election. I think that politically it would be very, very unpopular. So I don't think that's a clear, an easy political solution. Personally, I think it would be a more effective one, and I think it would be a better one for there to be transparency that these people are actually politically responsible to the movement that they serve. I think that's more honest, and I think it's better.
I agree. I think the key thing here has been a change of what's fashionable and what seems to work in an argument to the public. It used to be the case for 20 years or so that you could say, we're going to take the politics out of an important topic. Whether you're taking the politics out of parts of policing, whether you're taking the politics out of environmental regulation, you know, I think we can all think of examples of politicians saying this shouldn't be a political football and therefore we're establishing a quango, harvesting it out to somebody else to review and run. The problem is that as increasingly fundamental and important policy areas and increasingly large budgets have been run in that way, with supposedly the politics taken out, it turns out what that really means is with the people doing it insulated from the people paying for it. And when you don't have that accountability, this is what happens. Look at what the Environment Agency appears to have done in the Somerset Levels. It spent an awfully large amount of money essentially reversing the success of several centuries in reclaiming this land from the sea. And people are understandably angry. What we need to do is have an upfront political argument made to say we need to bring these things back under democratic control. And that means, it will mean that politicians will be able to appoint people who see the world in the same way that they do, whose job is to help them fulfil their policies, not to obstruct them. But by the same token, it means the voters and taxpayers should be able to sack them. That, I think, has got to be the way this is pitched. Otherwise, if it's done by sleight of hand or in some way done sneakily, then it's going to be a disaster. But moving towards that American system, where we're open about the fact that the people who pay for a service and the people who are on the receiving end of it, people who rely on it, should have a say in how it's run, that ought to be a pretty straightforward principle. But we've got to have the the political guts to make the case.
And of course, the accusation will just simply be a politicisation of the civil service, and it'll become the endless football of what the civil service really is for and what it's there to do.
And also, there's a problem, which is that, you know, say if you look at the American system, there are two strong breaks on it. First is that Congress is often not controlled by, or the Senate is often not controlled by the party making the appointments, and that provides a kind of pretty strong break on who is acceptable. You know, you can't just nominate, anybody. You have to nominate someone who you think is going to get through the nomination and scrutiny process. And then the second element is that there is a pretty strong system of local power, which limits the role of the federal government anyway. So that it ends up, even though those people get appointed, as a more collaborative and partnership approach than it appears on the surface. In the British system, you would need to find some way of making that scrutiny real and making sure that inappropriate people weren't appointed, which would be difficult in our system. And then you'd also need to find some way of making sure that there was always a voice for those who disagreed and that they were able to make that case outside of the organisation, because otherwise you'd end up with a very centralised, powerful, politically led state that would be able to ride roughshod over pretty much any objection. I think that would be problematic.
Absolutely. I mean, in the British constitutional model, this is being done in the traditional way, which is by fudge and by slowly creeping in the right direction. You know, I think we've seen some improvements in the way that Parliament reviews some public appointments lately. And remember, I mean, even the current Children's Commissioner, whose name escapes me, when she was first nominated by Ed Balls, the Select Committee, before the last election, the Select Committee vetoed her because, despite being majority Labour MPs, they vetoed her essentially because they thought she would be too much one of his creatures. You know, that culturally was a big step in the right direction from parliamentarians. Unfortunately, the structure of the system meant Ed Balls just ignored them and appointed her anyway. So, you know, we do have big changes that have got to be made, but it's clear we can't just carry on as we are. You know, I think the Bonfire of the Clangos, so-called, which must be the 10th or 11th edition of the Bonfire of the Clangos in recent years, Francis Maude, I think, has made some improvements. Some of that is just on paper, where he saved HR and accountancy departments by rolling Clangos into one another. Some of it is perfectly validly by shutting down some, but ultimately, now you're down to brass tacks, a lot of these bodies, the things they actually do for a living, are currently part of the state, and they will remain part of the state under any of the main three parties for the foreseeable future. The question is, who do they answer to? And, you know, we've got to face up to the fact we need a change in how Parliament works, we need a change in how the civil service works. And I would not be opposed to looking, for example, at the idea that governments get to appoint the civil servants as the head of each department. That shouldn't be incompatible with these kind of changes.
Well, speaking of changes to way Parliament works, speaking of localism, maybe we could move on to our third and, I think, final topic of the night, which is, I'm going to put it in the form of a question. Is it wise to make a speech imploring Scotland to stay part of the Union from London? Mark?
I think it's wiser than David Cameron going to Edinburgh or Glasgow to do it, which is, I know that's hedging my bets there, but David Cameron is in a somewhat sticky situation when it comes to Scotland. He's confessed quite publicly that he is not the most appealing figure to persuade the Scottish people to vote in favour of staying in the Union. However, he's also A, the Prime Minister, and B, the leader of the Conservative and Unionist Party, as commenters on Conover constantly reminding us is the full name. And therefore, he can't be seen to remain silent on the topic either. I thought it was actually, despite the kind of debate about the setting, one of his better speeches in recent times that he made on Friday. Firstly, it was hilarious to see senior members of the SNP come out and say it's wrong to politicise sporting events, at which point immediately Twitter was filled with photos of Alex Salmond producing that saltire at Wimbledon, waving over Cameron's head. I thought it was a pretty good speech. I personally am not that fussed, really, whether Scotland stays or goes in the Union. I think there are, as a Tory from the northeast of England, I think there's quite a lot of understandable resentment that there's such a big focus on the future of Scotland and still so little discussion of the constitutional and financial and fiscal settlement for large parts of England. But I think there ought to be perhaps bigger priorities for us. I thought the speech as go is pretty good.
Hopi, are you an impassioned unionist?
Well, the Conservative and Unionist, Mark's commenters need to be reminded that the Conservative and Unionist Party is actually a reference to the Liberal Unionists, and it's a reference to Ireland, not the union with Scotland.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah,
they're wrong about that. So I get very cross when people get confused about that.
Wrong in the comments of the blog.
Yeah, I know. On the union with Scotland, I think that Cameron is in an almost impossible position. He shouldn't be involved in debate because it is in many ways an internal Scottish debate. But as Prime Minister, he has to make a case for the union. And I think a degree of passion, but also a degree of distance is required. And I think his approach is probably broadly right. I actually think he would do well to reach out and act sort of as non-partisanly as is possible in this debate. If I was him, the one change I would have made to that speech at the Velodrome was I'd have invited Gordon Brown along, because it would have shown that made the point that you can be Prime Minister of Britain and a Scot, and which is not something that would be possible after independence. And also, Brown was intimately involved with the planning and execution of the Olympics. And I think it would be a nice touch to recognise that. I think he was broadly right. The one thing I think it would be somewhat better for him to try and do would be to try and to kind of build in that more in his campaigning activities. But I don't think there's much anyone else from England could do better than how he's done it. And leaving it the actual kind of street fighting to those in those actually in Scotland is absolutely the right
decision. I've had this argument with friends of mine from the Labour Party who are very worried that Labour nationally aren't doing enough about the threat of Scotland leaving. Scottish friends of mine. In fact, I spent the day with one yesterday, and a lovely day it was too. But I said, as far as I'm concerned, the most damaging thing that London-based England-based Labour activists can do is march up to Scotland and try to tell them what to do, because I think that's counterproductive.
Well, someone was trying to tell me that I needed to phone people in the central booth of Glasgow, and I just had this vision of the thing that The Guardian did in the 2004 US election.
Precisely.
I'm wrong, but I would feel that canvassing session would not go particularly well.
And as far as I'm concerned, if I want Scotland to stay part of the union, which I pretty much do, then the best thing I can do is keep my head down and hope the polls stay as they are.
Well, that would be my feeling. But then, if it got close, I suspect everyone would be asked to throw everything in anyway. So.
Yes, but I'm making my excuses for inaction early.
Exactly. Maybe if it gets very close just before the referendum, we'll see huge amounts of English activists being asked to go north and just keep entirely silent while they dish leaflets out.
We don't have to run out of leaflets.
I don't know, I think maybe we can start preparing now and have Scottish accent classes being held for various...
I think that would be even better. Let's all go up there and sound like some awful Rabsy Nesbitt stereotype that we've nicked off the telly.
What could possibly go wrong? I think there is one aspect of this which from a kind of parochial conservative point of view is I don't think many people have noticed so far, which is that the Scottish Tories obviously have a pretty tricky task in terms of where do they fit, because they know that they are not by any means the biggest party in Scotland. They know that they are very electorally challenged, but on the other hand, there's quite a lot of voices within Scottish Toryism who see this referendum as an opportunity, as perhaps the opportunity they need to rebuild and revitalise their machine. And certainly last autumn they were testing out what effectively a new trial model of party membership, which if it works, could well be kind of rolled out to the rest of the UK, where you can become a Conservative Friend of the Union in Scotland for free. And they essentially trawled every database they had, wrote to and emailed everyone they could. And that, as an organisation, it's free to join. It has more than 10 times the membership of the Conservative Party in Scotland and has raised more money through voluntary donations as a result. And I'm not saying that's going to be the deciding factor in the referendum by any means, but I think we could actually see effectively the referendum becoming a little bit of a petri dish for how the Conservative Party might revitalise its own membership across the rest of the country as well. We can kind of a much more voluntary model where we manage to move away from charging people for the pleasure
associate
of
associate members. Sounds very familiar, Hopi, don't you think?
Yeah. But I think it's right. If I was the Conservative Party, I would see this as a huge opportunity to recruit members and supporters and rebuild a grassroots network that has basically fallen into disrepair. And also, look, I think I'm right in that a lot of the seats that the Conservative Party will be looking to gain are ones where if there is a fall or a crisis in the SNP after a referendum, then that's where the opportunity would be found, would be seen. So it's politically, I think it would be right for the Conservative Party to put quite a lot of effort into supporting that.
I can absolutely see the benefit to that to the Conservative Party in Scotland. But Mark, let me ask you a bald-faced question. Wouldn't the Conservative Party as a whole, the English Conservative Party, or the English and Welsh and Northern Irish Conservative Party, be actually secretly rather thrilled if Scotland buggered off with all their Labour MPs?
Well, it's a little bit like the saying that you should never ever bet in favour of your own football team. So the fact that if you, most Tories have this very emotional link to the Union and would in that sense be sad if Scotland was to leave. However, you'd have that effect, your football team loses, but on the other hand, you do at least win your bet in that if we were to see a load of Labour MPs vanish, if we were able to say to English voters, tell you what, we're not having to fork out for the Barnett formula anymore, we'll be able to look more at a more financial assistance perhaps, or for example, more targeted tax cuts towards parts of the north of England, which is somewhere where the Conservative Party has obviously been extremely lacking for some decades. I think quite a lot of people could see the upsides. Certainly, personally speaking, I've got a little bit tired of Scottish politicians demanding that they should A, have a say in matters that are effectively affecting England and Wales. We should give them the Barnett formula for the privilege, and then taking the mick out of us for being English. It does get a bit tiresome. So I think, in a political sense, I think people could probably see practical upside.
Okay, well, so on the bombshell, Tories not wholly sad if we were to see Scotland go. I think I might have to wrap that up now. But I'd like to take this opportunity to thank both Mark and Hopi for joining me tonight. I think it's been a great discussion, so thank you both. And I'd also like to thank Audioboo for hosting the podcast and Kevin MacLeod at incompitech.com for our funky theme music. And next week, I believe it will be Mark hosting. Mark, our recovering Lib Dem blogger.